So what I'm going to talk about tonight is this topic, towards the privacy aware web. And before I get into that, I'll just give you a very brief overview of what National ICT Australia is all about, or NICTA. Basically, we're a federally funded ICT research institute started about 4 years ago. The Australian government decided that it needed a national identity and a national ICT research institute. So NICTA was formed. We've got quite a lot of money, $400 million Australian for 10 years. And we set up five labs around Australia with roughly 500 odd staff and about 200 PhD students, because we are affiliated with a number of universities as well around the country. And obviously our main objective is research. It's sort of like fundamental research, as well as being applied to real-world scenarios. So we have big strategic projects to do with water, traffic and public safety. We have 50 other smaller research projects. One of the projects we're about to begin is called, we're calling it PISA, the Policy Information Systems Architecture. And that's really what I'm going to talk about tonight, one of the new projects that we're working on. Of course, we also do a lot of linkages, educations and commercialisation about NICTA. So if you're interested, go to nicta.com.au and you can find out all the details about, and all the details of these 50 other projects, which are quite ranging. So let's start off with a bit of web history. The web, let's call it 1.0 for now. Start off with a very simple but effective infrastructure. Really, it was just simply about three things: HTTP, a new protocol, a new markup language, HTML, and a way to address resources with URLs, or URIs to be more precise. And then with web servers and web browsers, you know, we had a very simple way to communicate pretty much information purely mainly for the human to read. And that was sort of like the current state, if you like, you know, when the web started. And then we had all these what we call point upgrades throughout the last decade. You know, we had XML, and then we developed SOAP and web services and the semantic web and et cetera. But most of these don't always fit back into these two layers. You know, for example, your web browser today has no knowledge of the semantic web. You know, it's still really stuck around this technology here primarily. You have to write your own applications today if you want to utilise some of these special services, if you like. So they're not like core part of the infrastructure. So then we've been hearing about Web 2.0. Who's actually heard of the term Web 2.0? Is that a couple of views here? And it's an interesting term, 2.0. And here's one of the maps I got from from O'Reilly's, like one of their conferences. They put out this little map of the types of features, if you like, of Web 2.0. And it's really about, I suppose it's really about improving the user experience on the web. You know, so sites nowadays are really trying to get the user involved more and more, and we've seen that pretty well with some of the types of services like YouTube and that sort of stuff, where it's really about trying to attract the user, give them a good experience so they keep coming back. But in terms of the 2.0, you know, I'm not really sure what that really means. You know, I'm really a big question mark, but what does 2.0 mean for the web? Similar, I saw this one just a week as well. I was reading a white paper from Talos, which is a big company that does a lot of library integration software. And they decided to say, that, well, there's 1.0 over there, and here's Web 1 and here's Web 2. And for some reason, the only difference is the fact that you've got these clouds over here in Web 2, and somehow the internet is inside this stack here. So again, it's sort of like a lot of marketing hype around the term Web 2.0. And that really becomes a bit of a problem. So again, you sort of ask, well, what is Web 2.0? Hopefully at the end I'll tell you what my views are. So really, the current hype of the new web is about the user experience. And that's important. You need that. So the user feels comfortable doing and interacting with these sites. But really, the question that on my mind is about whether the user has the ability to instigate their rules on the web. So that is, what do I actually want to occur? What policies that I abide by, or want you to abide by, are actually honoured by the web? So that's really where I see the future is the user rules. And that's really what we're talking about by the policy-aware web, where the policy is basically your own rules or someone's rules. And we'll talk about the types of rules in a moment. And putting those rules into the web is really where the next sort of major advance will occur. So a bit of history, a bit more. Back in the late 90s, W3C, the Web Consortium, one of its very first specifications was called PIX, the Platform for Internet Content Selection. And it's really about, in those days, there's a bit of hysteria about adult content on the web and children accessing it. So W3C put out a standard called PIX, which basically would put a little bit of extra metadata on a web page that says this content contains the following rated material, just like you rate your movies, for example. And then with that rating on every web page, then your user agent or your web browser can say, hang on, I know you're an under 18-year-old child, therefore I won't let you access these rated websites. And that was obviously all purely by an honor system. And basically, these type of systems, the idea was good, but the implementations weren't that well regarded. So basically, it never got anywhere. Now, a few sites use it, but then no one uses it today. Then W3C got into privacy. So with P3P, it's in about 2000 onwards. And again, P3P is another standard which really is about trying to encode some rules into the web. And again, the same sort of thing. Some people use it today, but not that many. Has anyone here used PIX or P3P on their day-to-day experience? Probably not many, no, neither do I. So. And then a year later, even W3 tried to get into digital rights management as well. We held a workshop with them. But again, that really didn't move any forward. I think there was a lot of non-technical issues about privacy, which really scared W3C, because once you start talking about privacy, you have all these groups starting to say, well, you have to do it this way, or you can't do it that way. So the technology gets lost amongst all that discussion. So there are policies everywhere when you look out today, and I mentioned two of them, privacy and rights, and they're probably the biggest ones, the greatest impact. And then there are other policies like identity, access control, context, preferences, quality of service, you name it, all these policies are out there and people are working with them. So the current state, you know, these are mostly formal, mostly informal, but some of these are formal. And a lot of projects going around the world developing these types of policy languages. So we've got P3P. In the European Union, there's a big project called PRIME, which is doing more stuff on privacy. France has talked about ODRL, the rights language that the company I used to work for developed. And OASIS Standards Group, there's XACMEL, which is Access Control Policy Language. And that list can go on and on and on. But basically all these types of projects, that they basically try and address the needs of their specific community and their specific needs. But when you look at it, I mean, it's very useful, as we've seen it in a second, some of the commonalities across these policies and the ability to say, well, if there's a common way to do policies, why don't we do that first and then do your extensions later instead of everyone doing their own. So just a few examples. I apologise to those who don't like to read XML or some type of script, but that's a PIX example of PIX. And this is a little bit of text that you're supposed to put inside your header of your HTML page. And your browser was supposed to read this, see the ratings here, and then match it to your own particular preferences, and then decide whether you should actually display that page or not. So this is basically a set of rules that tells the web browser whether to display this page or not. Same with P3P and privacy, basically a set of rules about, you know, what consequences will happen if you continue with this transaction, what will happen, you know, what the state of purpose is, so this was about when you purchase something from this website, what they'll actually do with your personal information. And this goes on for a long while, this is only a small subset. And then you've got more complex privacy models now emerging. This is one called Ray, and this is influenced a lot by the semantic web some of the community there developing a model for privacy. And when you look at it, you can sort of see things like there are sort of like rights and obligations. There's obligations here. There's actions that you can do. There are constraints. There are preconditions. There are priorities over here, and you're granting policies. There's all these sort of terms that you'll see come along quite common. And that's obviously now getting a more complex model. Going back to rights, Creative Commons is an example of very simple rights language or rights policy. And they actually have a mechanism where they actually allow you to say, well, here's a human readable policy. So you're a human, you can read that and you can find out what what the rights are for using this content. So it's very simple. You have to attribute the use if you reuse it, and you have to share alike, which means that if you change this content and you make it, you distribute it, then you've got to have the same rights. So there's simple rules for the human. And then for the lawyers, there's a nice legal version, so it keeps the lawyers happy. And then for the machine, there's a bit of XML. In case a bit of XML right here. And this gives you what you're permitted to do, what you're required to do, and what you're prohibited from doing. Some simple rules. But in most cases, for Creative Commons, for example, machines don't do anything when they read this. I mean, for example, prohibiting commercial use is a very difficult thing for a machine to do. It's hard to determine whether you're selling something and what you're doing with it. So there's some examples there of people, a lot of policy languages, many cases can't be enforced. But what they can do is simple things like help discover things. So that rights policy called Creative Commons, Google is actually indexing content with that information. So in the advanced search of Google, there's a little extra thing called usage rights over here, and you can pick up what type of rights are available. So if you want to find content that has particular rights attached to it, then you can use Google to find that. So useful for discovery. Sticking more with rights, here's another rights model. And this is the core of ODRL, and basically there's a lot of rights instead of here, permissions, constraints, conditions, requirements, and we'll see these terms of a few coming up, and there's people, parties with different roles. Then rights can be more complex. This is what ODRL version 2 is heading down. I won't go into the details, but as you can see, there's more complexity in these policies. And in here we have things like prohibitions and permissions. For example, going on there, that action there are duties, which are an important part of any policy language, which is what you as a human have to do before you're allowed to access the content. And then we have in the geospatial world, they're also interested in digital rights management policies, but they've taken a different view. They've taken a very simplistic view of having four different types of policies: a private policy, a public policy, a commercial policy, and an emergency policy, which is very interesting, this one. And because we're also doing a project on public safety, this one here allows you to basically break all these in case of emergency. So if you need information and there's a tsunami coming, then you can break all those rules and get access to them, which is quite important in some circumstances. So back to simple rights. Apple has been very successful with its iTunes and service, selling the most content on the web, or music content in particular. But most people don't realise that embedded in the content is actually a very simple DRM implementation, Apple's own proprietary one. And it has a very simple rule, which is you can share your music on four other computers. Very simple policy that they can enforce. And there's probably not a policy language, it's probably a little bit somewhere in the data that says how many times you can copy it and tracks how many times you can do it. So policies can be well hidden from the user. They don't have to get in their way of everyday use. Context is another model that's becoming a very important one, because context is important because it really changes everything, because whatever the different context is for a particular situation, then different types of outcomes can occur. So situations which are based on a number of facts, you as a user may have a preference of what to do under those in that particular situation. And you also may rate those preferences. So I'll rate the one more higher than the other, and then from that, some action occurs. So this is a general model context which people are trying to put into some of the policy languages. So that in whatever the context happens to be, whether you're at home or versus you're at work, so you have different contexts. So things might occur differently from some of your preferences at work, could be different than your preferences at home. So you need some type of context model to capture those differences to enable you to work more effectively. And this is the final one, which is access control. This is the ExactMall model, XACML. And again, you can see things like actions, subjects, resources, there's policies, obligations, there's rules, conditions. You know, sort of a lot of similar things happening. So when you look at all those policies that are going on at the moment, you sort of see a lot of commonality. And here I've sort of grouped together the different sort of words in similar areas. So this is all about the resources, you know, content, resource, asset, object, whatever you want to call it. These are all about some type of constraint. These are all about some type of obligation that you have to do. These are all about what you can do, permissions, actions. This is what you can't do. These ones are about sort of like the context or facts or your environmental issues. Then there's also information about people. And then there are actually then the policy themselves and the rules. So you may have a set of rules that govern all these types of common terms here. So you can see there's a lot of commonality there. So I suppose the opportunity is there to sort of say, well, let's see if we can actually build this a common model here for a policy, and then see whether all those different policy languages out there can actually use that common policy model. Therefore, if I'm writing software and I need to do a rights policy, manage rights policy, an access control policy, a privacy policy, I don't have to have three different vertical implementations that I need to worry about. I can just manage policies from a general point of view and then manage the differences, hopefully not so dramatic differences. So from a graphical point of view, from a diagram point of view, that sort of the common model really is about you as individual, people up here, want to do things with resources. That's the common part of the model. And basically, you have the ability to say, well, to do something, you have to do something for me, a duty, which means you pay me $1, or you don't do something as well. So that's sort of like the core model, if you like. And then wrapped around all that is the sort of the context and rules that applies to all of those. And that can change the duties and the constraints, the actions, as well as the resource as well, can change on different contextual situations. So one of the things that we are working on, I suppose, in our research project that we're starting now, called with the one I mentioned at the beginning, is looking at what would be a policy framework. How will we get to a particular framework where we can start to exploit all these common policies? So here is like the path we're looking at going down. So obviously the first one is, you know, which is pretty key for any standard that you want to develop, is about gathering requirements. And then developing some type of abstract reference model, something that captures all that commonality I just talked about in the previous screen. And then work out, well, how can we express that abstract reference model in various ways. And I'll put plural there because there might be multiple ways of doing it. And then really the final step is more at the implementation level. How would you architect systems that use this expression of this abstract model? So this may be architectures based on particular technologies or particular environments, etc. So this is still sort of an abstract policy language. So you then need to be able to get communities and sectors to plug in their own vocabulary or ontologies for what they mean by these typical actions and constraints, etc. Because we can't really standardise on every single action, every single constraint, every single duty in the world. There's got to be a lot of communities who develop that, but they plug those into this this layer above. So what that looks like a bit graphically, you know, we have this policy abstract reference model, which is expressed by different mechanisms. So we're looking at it, you know, obviously there will be probably an expression in the semantic web, but also probably be one in the structured web, for those who don't particularly feel that keen on the semantic web just yet. And then each of those can be manifested in particular architectures. So there could be one based on web services, one based on Ajax, one on mobile over-the-air technologies, and whatever. So this is really getting down to the nitty-gritty implementation. So, but all of these will be based on this same reference model. So the idea is that if you take mobile content from here and it appears over here in a web service on the internet, then you have the same same core understanding of the policy language, so that you can easily translate, if needed, between them and still understand the policy and how to enforce the policy, etc. So a lot of requirements that we need to look at. Obviously, you know, these are some of them I've just listed here about having transparent policies, being able to have compliant policies, particular real-world rules. Accountability is quite important, because in some cases where you can't have an environment where you're going to actually enforce policies, and all you're going to do is actually just inform people of policy. If someone does something wrong, you really can't stop them. But what you'd like to do is the ability to be able to track that they did something wrong, so that later on you can say, well, in fact, you know, 3 days ago you did this when you shouldn't have, because the policy didn't say that. So you need to be able to have some way to account for your actions. Because it's very unlikely that we'll have an environment where there's going to be pure enforcement of all policy languages. It's just going to be, that's going to be way too hard to do that. So then that really comes down to the matter of trust. How do you trust that a system is going to honour your policy? So we have to look at the benefits of having a full enforcement mechanism that is trusted client software, versus how well the community accepts your policies. Like, give you a good example there, the two different communities. This community here, the enforcement world, is something that, for example, the Open Mobile Alliance does really well. So on the mobile phone, you have a very strong user rights management software, and it's totally trusted, it's, everything's encrypted. Everything's, all the software is certified, etc. All the devices have certificates. But over in this, and in here, for example, the Creative Commons world, where all you have is a bit of three lines of XML that's attached to your web page, people accept that. People use it, because there's about 2 million pages out there with Creative Commons licenses in them. So people are happy to accept them. So there's a big sort of difference, and you have to work out where you're going to sit in these extremes here. The other sort of more interesting requirement is how you then start looking at addressing conflicts in the policies, particularly in policies that says you can do one thing and a policy that says, well, in fact, you can't. I prefer that you didn't do it that, or you did it a different way. And trying to work out how to address that and to prioritise some of the outcomes. And that may be well dealing with some of the more intricacies of context management, which just adds another layer of complexity. There's also a number of then policy models we need to capture for across the communities. So basically, I've really shown you so far mainly the information models. Those diagrams I went through, that's mainly how the information is captured. There's all these other models which we need to look at, particularly in negotiation model, because in some cases it's not just a matter of saying, here's my policy and that's it. In many cases it's, well, let's negotiate. Let's be flexible. Let me sort of enter a conversation with you and say, well, you let me sort of change this bit of the policy, and do you accept that? And then have a negotiation between two parties. And that's something that, for example, in the rights world, they want to do a lot. You want to be able to negotiate online and via electronic mechanisms across these policies. So I've talked about enforcement, and then there's a consent model, which is really a big issue in the privacy world. How do you consent to giving out your email address, for example? And how do you know that the people who have taken your email address, they said they only use it for one particular purpose, may use it for other purposes? And basically these models then add a lot more rules to the way that we try and build the policy aware web and try and put that into the web infrastructure. So I won't go through all these, but here are some of the research challenges that we see for the project that we work on, and also a number of research, similar research projects are going on around the world in the area of the policy aware web. And I've mentioned a few of them. Things like those who are really keen logicians would like to get into this one here, but how do you reason about policies? Then there are people who want to be like, well, if we're going to have lots of policies related to that interrelated, how do you actually visualise them? How do you actually map them together? And I mentioned about inconsistencies in policies, and of course accountability and how do you evaluate it, compliance, transparency. And of course, the final thing you want to do is you need to be able to standardise all this. And obviously, the W3C is the obvious way to do that, but it's not always the clearest and mechanism to do it either. So this is what the current semantic web stack, which sometimes is used as the de facto architecture for the web that W3C has published. And as you can see, there's sort of like, you know, we have this, you know, URIs down here, Unicode, XML at this level. Then we move up to RDF and RDF schema, and now here, so we have the semantic web starting appearing around here. And then we have these things like unifying logic, or this bottom layer is proof and trust up here, which we're nowhere near at the moment. So somewhere in there we need to be able to work out where does the policiness occur? What sort of extra features need to be there to enable us to work out what is the policy framework? Where does it fit within the architecture of the web? So when we look at the architecture and we try to work out, well, where does this fit with what you and I do for our day-to-day job? So for us, for example, you know, the current mechanisms we use would be a web browser at one end, a web server at the other end. And somehow in between the two, we need to be able to have a lot more mediation of services than what we currently have today. So even today, for example, between a standard web browser and a standard web server, you're lucky to get this much support here. Now, if you want anything above here, you really have to write your own custom software. You know, if you want to do RDF, semantic web stuff, then you're really talking about customized both servers and clients. But that really doesn't make it really accessible for the entire world then, even if you're talking about a semantic web or policy language, policy rules up in these higher layers here. They have to be able to start appearing in your own web browser and has to start appearing in your web server, those types of services. And it may be that just like HTTP, for example, we have a secure version of that HTTPS. There may be a need for a new protocol as well to enable that to occur. Trying to force it all in the same protocol might not be the best way forward. So in terms of growing up, so the web browser really needs to grow up and become a web user agent, which really has a lot more interaction with you as a user and is managing your user policies. So that may be your privacy policies, it may be all the rights policies that you already have acquired from other sources, maybe other types of policies that you have, your preferences. And then really it has to be able to have some trusted behaviour. And again, I'll leave the word trust there to be defined by your own community, what we mean by trust. Because if you don't trust the behaviour of your web user agent, then people are unlikely to be able to unlikely to interact with you in any particular real way. And the same thing for the web server. It's got to become a more of a web content agent where it's got to be much more smarter about content. And it's got to manage the policies about content as well. And so it's got to have a lot more ability in there for you as a publisher of information to be able to publish your content, the policies about your content, and then also have the ability, like its cousin up here, Trusted Behaviour, that when you do put content on your web content agent, you will also be able to make sure that when those policies go out and they say that here is a rights policy or whatever, that they actually will be enforced somehow. Not necessarily in a technical way, but we actually will travel with the content at least and make it to the other end for the user to at least be able to interact with that policy. So let's have a quick look at a couple of use cases. So let's say over here, for example, this is you over here, your web user agent, and here are your own policies. So your agent knows about your policies, understands them. Over here we have the web content agent, so this is someone who's publishing content of some form, and they have policies related to the content that gets published. And basically what can happen is a request will come across, say, I want to buy or obtain, or whatever the commercial terms are in here, that's all part of the transaction, some content, and it says, no problems, here's the content and here's the rights policy that comes along with it. So what could happen then? Of course, it could be we fine. You know, it could be the policy says that you can use this content for 1 year for educational purposes, or I paid my $10 and you can use it forever. Whatever the rules happen to be, and that's fine. So that will probably be 95% of the cases. It will just hopefully work. But the difference here is that today you can't do that. I mean, I can't buy content over the web today from any provider that my web browser manages for me and manages the link between the content and the policy. In the mobile world, for example, in your mobile phones, particularly ones that support the Open Mobile Alliance, DRM, this does happen because your mobile phone has trusted software on it that always makes sure that the content you have on your mobile phone is always associated with a license to use it. So when you go to play the video on your mobile phone, it just doesn't automatically play the video. It looks at the policy that says, do you have the right to play the video? Then if you do have the right to play the video, then it plays the video. So it also looks at any other constraints. So you may have the right to play the video 10 times. And so we'll be tracking that as well. So this happens in the mobile world. But the difference in the mobile world is that they have complete control over this entire value chain here. So you buy a new mobile phone and you get the software, and that they can build content servers as well to do that. A bit harder in the web world. No one owns the entire web, so they can't go and force you to somehow buy a new web agent on your laptop. So it's a bit slightly harder sort of it's a harder architecture to follow. So if you remember that the diagram we had, which had the abstract model and the representations and the architectures, it's a much harder one to follow on the open web. So what else could happen here, of course, is that you get the rights policy, and it may then conflict with your privacy policy. So the rights policy could say, well, here's the content, you can use it for a year, but I'm going to track your usage, which is what a lot of licenses actually do that. But that conflicts with your privacy policy. So what you can do is you can say, no, sorry, it's a conflict, I'm not happy with it. And of course today you can't do that because this language and that language are completely different. There's no commonality between them. So you can't tell, you can't map. Well, we can't map easily, we could do it one-on-one, but there's no general way to say, well, here's a general rights policy and it conflicts with your privacy policy. That's very difficult to do today. So that's one example where having a common policy model would help you establish that. Then in another use case where probably the idea where you are obviously buying content from multiple sources, coming across to your user agent, different rights policies. So in some of those cases it may work fine, but in other cases there may be conflicts in just your rights policy, so that may be flagged or need to be able to negotiate over those rights policies. But then, of course, what happened a lot in the internet world is you do things like you distribute the content to your friends, so you send it off to your friend, and that may be allowed in one of these rights policies, the fact you redistribute content, or may not. And of course, then that, if that's not allowed, then this user agent up here would say, sorry, you can't forward this to your friends, because the rights policy that came across here said you can't do it. And that, again, I'd use the open mobile line, sort of mobile sector world, and that's where that actually happens today. There's an enforcement point here which allows you to do this or not do this. So, and the rights policy says, yes, you can forward the content, or no, you can't forward the content. But even if you did, forward the content onto your friends, and then the same thing could happen. Your friend down here could say, well, in fact, I don't want the content because that conflicts with my user policies as well. And then that chain can go on for forever and ever. So that's sort of, you'd hope to give me a quick little use case scenarios of some of the potential ways where it could be used. And I'm sure there are many, many others. I've just picked two policies, privacy and rights. And there's probably a lot more. There's probably some more fundamental ones like access control policies as well, which is something that's very difficult today to generalize across the internet. So I suppose the policy aware web, as I started off giving you some examples of web 2.0 that's currently being used in the marketing of a lot of companies, from our point of view, the real web 2.0 would be the policy aware web. If you're talking about a version upgrade of anything, then something like adding these types of features would be the most significant way to get to a 2.0 of the web. And that really would help. The W3C's catchphrase is leading the web to its full potential. And as you can hopefully can see, that's really supporting a policy-aware web in the infrastructure of the internet would be a real way of doing that. And that will open up a whole lot of new opportunities if you can get to a point where we can start sharing policies that are somehow trusted and manageable about the browser and the server end. And that also open up these huge opportunities for all these communities out there who, at the moment, who are building their own policy language. And we are getting into this vertical nightmare, because to support 10 policies, you need to know all the details of 10 different policies and how to map across them, which is a typical computer science problem, which never seems to go away. So there is a huge interest out there at the moment to move towards this. And we believe that it's going to have a major impact on the future of the web. Hopefully you can sort of, from those very simple examples, you can sort of see the benefits to both the user, the content provider, And it also will then bring a lot more richness to some of the current web-type interactive services like your YouTube and stuff out there that currently occur. Particularly some of the YouTube stuff, they're very interested in some of the rights policies that people have uploading content which they may not have the rights to do. And also the privacy. I mean, people take videos of people and then upload them onto YouTube and, no regard of people's privacy as well. So there's a lot of these policies that could help. Doesn't mean that it will help, because in a lot of cases, people can take a picture of you and you don't know it. And it's very hard for them to get your consent to do that. So there's still a lot of human issues to deal with as well. So really, I want to wrap up there, because I really want to sort of take any questions from you guys about this area, and also really to also ask you a question. Now, what would you like to see the policy aware web do? What type of policies that interest to you and your organisations that you think would be useful to add to the big list of policies that we already have out there? So with that, I'll conclude, and thank you very much, and happy to answer any questions.